Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Chris Parker, Professor of Social Justice and Political Science at the University of Washington. He's the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics and the director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington and author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book is Change They Can't Believe in, the Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Parker.
I'm happy to be back, and Happy New Year to you, albeit belated.
And happy Martin Luther King Day, I guess, since we're speaking on Martin Luther King Day. And
tell
me, what's your sense then of the legacy of Martin Luther King, in the political legacy in particular, in the context of the United States having its first black president, but at the same time, the Supreme Court recently gutted the Voting Rights Act that Dr. King fought and died for?
Well, so let me take the last question first. So I think the Voting Rights Act, you know, gutting Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, 1965, I think that was obviously a step backwards because it's really going to, I guess, bail out some of the states, quote-unquote bail out, that is to say, states that would have to pre-clear any changes to the voting laws in particular states. They are no longer held accountable. Now, having said that, and that was a huge blow, but having said that, there's a recent push for legislation, a bipartisan push for legislation to work around it, to effect a workaround on, you know, the gutting of Section 4. So there is some hope that we can find a way around this in the not-so-distant future, and it can be done so, you know, through the small-d democratic process. And I think that the courts would be loath to go back and try to redo that if it's done through the democratic process again. So I would say that, so to answer your first question, I would say that having the first African-American president, I mean, I think that can be, you know, significantly attributed to Dr. King and the cause for which he fought. And I think that, I mean, even if he's governing as a, you know, center-right or more to the right than some people would like, I mean, the fact of the matter is that we do have our first African-American president. And so that does mean a lot to a lot of people, not only in the United States, but around the world as well.
Well, Chris Parker, our previous guest was suggesting that towards the end of his life, Martin Luther King was more angry at white liberals and the black bourgeoisie than anybody else. Is that your recollection?
No, it's not. So if I understand this correctly, so in his letter from a Birmingham jail in 1963, he was angry at white moderates. I don't recall anything about white liberals at all. Now, it could be the case, and I've read quite a bit about Dr. King. That's part of what I do is black politics. I don't remember anything, you know, saying that he was upset at white liberals. White moderates, yes, because he thought it was a white moderates, especially in the South, because we're talking about 1963 in the South, that white moderates were, you know, permitting, if we could only get white moderates, he thought, on our side, then it would make our job a little easier in fighting for basic civil rights in the South. Now, this stuff on white liberals is very new to me. Now, as far as the black bourgeoisie, he was part of the black bourgeoisie, which is not to say that he, you know, could not be angry or disappointed with the black bourgeoisie, but I have no recollection at all, and I don't think I've ever read that any place, that he was angry at the black bourgeoisie.
Well, how would he be feeling today, though, given the mass incarceration of young black men?
Well, I mean, so his last campaign, or the campaign that he, on which he had embarked prior to his untimely departure from this world, was based on, it wasn't necessarily based on race. It was mainly based on class, the Poor People's Campaign. Now, we all know that race and class are really tightly linked empirically. So I guess I would say that, yeah, he would really feel upset about, you know, the extent to which black and brown people have been incarcerated vis-a-vis white men of comparable age and class. So it's no doubt about that. He would certainly be disappointed because there is a stigma that is associated with incarceration. It's been shown empirically time and time again that black men who have the same record as some white men, they have a much harder time finding employment opportunities than do similarly situated white men.
So, again, I'm speaking with Chris Parker, professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He's the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics and director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington and author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book is Change They Can't Believe in, the Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. And just going from your latest book, Chris Parker, my sense is, and in fact I spoke with Jared Ball, the previous guest, about this, is about how the Tea Party and the reactionary right have, in fact, arguably the Republican Party is using racism as a way to kind of bond, if you will, their base and motivate their base. That the moment there's obviously a war on the poor with the cut in food stamps and the unemployment benefits. And, you know, the point I was trying to make is that it seems to me that poor whites and poor blacks in this country have more in common than they have in terms of what separates them. But it seems to me that race is being used as a way to keep people thinking about class issues. And arguably, what we should be discussing is the extent to which we live in an oligarchy, not a democracy, and that our economy is a plutonomy.
Oh, I mean, yeah, Ian, I think you're spot on with that analysis. I think your analysis is right on point in that. I mean, we saw the same thing, you know, in close to the close of the 19th century and the early 20th century with the populist movement, where you had whites essentially use race to separate, you know, the black farmers from the white farmers in a populist movement. So, you know, we've seen this time and time and time again, you know, historically in the United States, that class is generally subordinated to race. Think about in a Jim Crow South in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. I mean, you had blacks and whites, poor blacks and whites that had, you know, class interests, you know, were aligned with each other, but race was used as a trump card to keep poor blacks and poor whites and working class whites and working class blacks apart. And so we're seeing the same thing now where, you know, where you're having race that mobilizes, you know, these, you know, working class and poor whites, you know, politically to vote essentially against their economic self-interest. So it's no question about that. That is happening right now. And this is not the first time we've seen this happen, as I've alluded to just a moment ago. And it certainly won't be the last time we see this happen.
So what's your sense then of the generation of politicians, African-American politicians that have succeeded the civil rights movement? We still have John Lewis, who's still a great fighter in the Congress. My friend Don Payne died some time back. I don't get the feeling that the mantle of Dr. King is necessarily being taken to new heights.
Now, if what you're referring to is this sort of civil rights genre in which, you know, social justice is at the top of the list, and I think your assessment is correct once again. I think that the sort of quote-unquote new black politicians, you know, they're playing more mainstream politics. They're, instead of sort of emphasizing race per se, what they're trying to do is they're trying to come at it, you know, in terms of class, which I think is a smart strategy, because once race is introduced, then what's going to happen is it's going to turn off, you know, those voters, mainly white voters, who are more likely, who are going to welcome class issues more, because when it comes down to race, they, you know, what the empirical literature has shown is that as soon as race is involved, or as soon as race is injected into the conversation, what happens is that turns them off to any sort of redistributive measures that would have been taken otherwise, or any redistributive policies, rather, that would have been undertaken otherwise. If they're more likely to react in a positive way if it's framed as a class issue versus a race issue, because it seems if it's a race issue, it's a zero-sum game. That's the way that they see this.
Well, I must say that lately watching these television award shows, you know, here I am broadcasting from Hollywood or North Hollywood across the street from Universal Studios. So many of these shows are, you know, the awards season is on now in Los Angeles, and you know, you turn on the television, it's just replete with celebrity worship. And I'm beginning to wonder whether celebrity worship, and let's face it, a lot of celebrities now are African-American, and certainly in sports. So I guess what I'm suggesting here is that it seems to me, economically speaking, we are entering a new feudalism. I mean, even one of the richest men in the country said a while back that we are in danger of becoming a plantation economy. So it seems to me that there is a kind of new feudalism underway with the war on the poor, the war on unions. At the same time, to quote Marx, the celebrity has become the new opiate of the masses.
The point is well taken, that religion is the opiate of the masses. And just to flesh that out a little further, as far as I understand the argument, it's the opiate of the masses because it puts their demands for change off, you know, until they die and they are reborn into a new life, and then they go to heaven and things will all be better, right? So right now, you know, their wants and desires and interests are put off until the afterlife. And so it makes it easier, as far as I understand, is, you know, for the upper classes or the ruling classes to lower it over the lower classes because religion is placating them, the lower classes. So that's just to fully flesh that out for your listeners. Now, moving forward, so celebrity is an opiate for the underclasses when it comes to their, as far as I understand you saying, is that it permits them to dream that, you know, maybe one day, you know, this can happen to me, or you making a reference to this is like pablum for them. They can just watch this and marinate in this and the celebrity worship. So therefore it will preclude them from taking any social action. Which one of these are you referring to?
I would say both are true, at least to my mind. And given the widening disparity in wealth in this country, where the poor are getting poorer and fewer of the rich are getting richer, it would seem to me that celebrity is in fact being peddled now as a way to, you know, maintain the delusion that we still have an American dream and that you know that you can make it. You know, the old Horatio Alger myth.
Yes, yes, yes. The whole Horatio. Yeah, yeah. If you work hard and you do the right thing, then one can make it in life. And I think that's part of the sort of American dream, or that's part of the American creed: hard work, and diligence, or just maintaining the Protestant work ethic or adhering to that, you know, will permit one to make it in life. And that's been part of the American creed from the very beginning, and it continues to be the case as public opinion data will reflect. But I think let's qualify this celebrity as an opiate for the masses. I mean, it's mainly an age and class thing, because I think that people that are older, let's say, you know, 40 and older, they're not really buying into this, because for them, you know, what are they going to be? They're going to be a basketball player, or they're going to be a football player? They're going to be a rap star at that age? Probably not. So we're talking about people who are younger and people who are, you know, working class or poor, who have those sort of aspirations because they think it's still possible for them. So I just wanted to make sure, you know, that we were, you know, that we, you know, we honed in on, you know, the groups to which this is relevant. It's the younger, you know, more working class or poor folks, you know, who have these aspirations, who have these hopes, and for which, you know, maybe celebrity does serve as an opiate.
Well, Chris Parker, I really appreciate you joining us here today on Martin Luther King Day and our conversation.
All right. Thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me back.
Again, I've been speaking with Chris Parker. He's a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He is the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics, director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington, and author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. His latest book just out is Change They Can't Believe In: The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.